Okay, welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our subject is the Whole 30 diet, which I talked about in part one. It's a paleo style diet, which is really going viral. And it's a phenomenon that is supported by some great resources on the internet, a couple of great books, social media, and is sort of a friendly way to dip your toe into the paleo diet phenomenon to see if it's for you, to see if it's beneficial, to see if it may help you with your particular health condition. So who is a candidate for the Whole 30? What do I think about that? Well, I certainly think that anyone with type 2 diabetes could really benefit from that, because it is a way of administering a low-carb diet in such a way that it really seems to tame cravings. I think that's one of the salient features of the Whole 30, is that sometimes you can tell people to curtail carbohydrates, eat less carbs, eat less carbs. That's the mantra these days. But without a coherent plan, it is very hard to resist the temptation to go back to carbs. So the theory underlying the Whole 30 is that it alters your satiety hormones. And this, I don't want to get too technical, but it has to do with hormones with strange names like leptin and adiponectin. And these and many others, some as yet to be discovered, govern our appetite and cravings. And it is thought that the Western diet, type of foods that we eat, subvert our appetite apparatus and get us to crave foods. Now, this may be by direct effects on the brain, by certain effects on the hormones like insulin, or it may even be via effects on the microbiome. It's thought that if you alter the microbiome, the bacteria in our intestine may determine whether we crave junk food. An illustration of that is that when we put people on zero-calorie artificial sweeteners, which theoretically shouldn't alter our appetite, people not only don't lose weight, they end up gaining weight. And it's thought that they may poison or harmfully alter the microbiome towards a state where we get signals from the bacteria in our intestinal tract, there's a gut-brain connection, to chow down on more carbohydrates or sugars that in turn perpetuate the growth of these harmful bacteria in a vicious cycle. So that's kind of an intriguing theory. And the Whole 30 would also be beneficial for people suffering from irritable bowel, gastrointestinal problems, certainly ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. It's similar in many ways to the diet that I now prescribe for patients with colitis, Crohn's disease, and diverticulitis, which is a grain-free diet, absent sugar, and certain other things that the Whole 30 prohibits. So that would be another category of people who would benefit from the Whole 30 diet. Also, people maybe suffering from fatigue. It might be really interesting to see if your fatigue is mediated by food intolerances or by certain gastrointestinal factors or by blood sugar fluctuations. Also, perhaps depression and anxiety might yield to the Whole 30 approach. People desirous of improved athletic performance might benefit from the Whole 30. I went into it with, I think, pretty good stamina and athletic performance. I wasn't unhappy about my athletic performance, but and at first I was a little bit concerned because maybe the first few days or week or so, I felt a little less energetic because it was almost as if my body was converting to a new fuel source. But after a week, my body just broke through, and I have been off the hook in terms of my swimming and spinning and running. Really very happy with the stamina that I've acquired. You know, I've lost. One of the things that's nice about the Whole 30 is they tell you not to weigh yourself during the process, so you're not compulsively jumping on and off the scale. So I waited, and at the end of 30 days, I found that I'd lost about 4 pounds, which I didn't necessarily go in there desiring that. But I found that, you know, just looking in the mirror, I felt I had a more sculpted look. I retained muscle because there's plenty of protein in this. You're not, you know, unlike some of these 500-calorie crazy weight loss programs, you're going to lose weight, but you're also going to kill your muscle. You will lose muscle. So I maintained muscle while maybe skimming off a little bit of the love handles. The other type of patient who might benefit, patients with autoimmune disease. We know that this diet is very similar to the Terry Walls MS diet. So patients with lupus, with rheumatoid arthritis, except for the inclusion of nightshades, which might be problematic for patients with arthritis, which you can easily modify the diet to exclude. This could be very beneficial. For a patient who is recovering from cancer, this is a lower carb diet that's very rich in nutrients, might help to trim insulin, which we believe might be a factor in promoting certain cancers. And so this might be a good preventive diet for somebody recovering from cancer. And, you know, on and on it goes. There are many medical conditions that this might be helpful for. I'll share with you. Yeah, I went to the website. I went to the Facebook page for the Whole 30, and I saw a lot of raves, but I zoomed in on some people who were kind of crybaby about it, and I'll share some comments from there. Coconut milk in my coffee just doesn't taste the same as real milk. That's one comment. My Whole 30 ranch dressing came out lumpy. I can't eat salad without ranch dressing. Here's another. What can I substitute for real ketchup on my hamburgers? What can I eat for breakfast? Those frittatas are too bland. Here's another one. It's day two and I feel terrible. And my response to that is, wah, wah, wah. You know, suck it up, crybabies, because, yeah, there's some austerity to this. And what I notice is the very people who complain the most about this, they are the people who are most fastidious in their tastes. And being fastidious in your taste, and really just very persnickety about it, this got to taste just right, is a recipe for obesity. Obese people really, 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 really pay a lot of attention to taste. And it has to be just, you know, the right way. And any deviation from that causes them great distress. And those people are in trouble. And this diet, you know, people are looking for some magical substitutes. They're always looking, and you see this in diet commercials sometimes. It's like, eat the foods you love. Eat pizza, eat bread, you know, eat the delicious chocolate dessert. And you see these pictures and you go, and these people are losing scads of weight. How do they do it? Well, I don't know what they put in those foods, like, you know, sawdust or chemicals, you know, to make them seem like real food. But the idea behind the whole food is you're going to switch the script on your tastes and on your food preferences to get you away precisely from those foods that get you in trouble. And there is going to be some hell to pay. There's going to be some withdrawal. It ain't going to be pretty for some people, particularly if you're coming from a very bad diet. And so that, these people, to them I say, you don't get it about this diet, because you're reaching back to your prior food proclivities and you want some magic substitute for the foods that you love. You know, what can I take that's like popcorn? You know, it's like, no, you're not. The idea is you're supposed to eat and it turns off your appetite. And you don't need to snack, and you don't crave dessert, and you don't crave the chips and the things that you normally superimpose on your base caloric requirements. Not that this is supposed to be like torture, you're supposed to eat food that tastes bad. I've really enjoyed my food experiments. I've made delicious breakfast frittatas. I take 10 or a dozen eggs and scramble them, and I mix them with artichokes and dried tomatoes and sliced boiled tomatoes. I put it in a big frittata, put it in the oven for a while, and then I have like a big kind of egg pie that I can slice and have breakfast for the week. Or alternatively, I might make a frittata with spinach and onions and potatoes. The potatoes make it a little more heavy and substantial, kind of like a Spanish tortilla, if you've ever been in Spain. It's like a very hearty kind of meal. I'll have chicken and fish and lots of eggs. I'll have bacon. I'll have, I made a delicious meatloaf the other night with mushrooms, carrots, onions, and, of course, grass-fed ground beef. I've made some great lamb stews with lamb and Middle Eastern spices and onions and stewed tomatoes. And I've taken some pictures of these things and shared them on the Internet. So it's a very satisfying kind of diet. It's gotten me to focus more on ingredients on my food choices. There's not a lot of shortcuts to, you know, like you can always pop some, you know, gluten-free bread in the toaster and put some peanut butter on it, and, you know, that's a quick fix. Well, instead, I've got pistachio butter, and I've got plenty of celery and carrot sticks around. I can dip the celery and carrot sticks or peppers in a jar of pumpkin seed butter, which is allowed, or pistachio butter, or what's called sun nut butter, which is sunflower butter. These are, in the Hartwig's estimation on Whole30, preferable substitutes for peanut butter. And instead of having the bread, you're having the vegetables. So those are some of the things that I'm having, and I'm, you know, doing okay on it. I'm getting used to it. I'm getting used to the food preparation, the shopping. I made this really nice a crepe-like breakfast the other day. I felt like something special on a Sunday. So with one egg, I just, you know, scrambled one egg, coated a stainless steel pan very thinly with it like a crepe, added to it some frozen blueberries that I'd thawed, and something called coconut nectar, which is a product that's kind of a specialty product. But it's basically coconut pulp with it's coconut meat, but it's unsweetened, but it tastes sweet when your taste buds have acclimated to the diet. So it's like coconutty blueberry crepe. And, you know, then I rolled it up like a crepe and had it, and I said, great. And then I made two more. So, you know, three eggs, some coconut oil, and some blueberries. That's a pretty good hearty breakfast. And, you know, and I didn't put sugar or maple syrup on it spoil the effect. So I will share with you the impression of it. What's nice about this is that I've been talking about this, and it's gone out to a lot of people who, you know, think of me as a little bit of a role model or an explorer on their behalf. And they've said, great, well, that looks good. I'll try it. So I got someone who works for my media team to try it. Actually, all the people on my media team are trying it to some degree or another, and a lot of family members are trying it. But this is a guy who got particularly good results. I went to the office the other day to chat, and he was just raving about it. And I'll just read you a quote in its entirety, what he had to say, because I think it really sums it up. He writes, "As I turn 50 later this year, I realize I've been on and off diets, battling weight for at least 40 years. It's a constant struggle. It feels like I've tried every diet ever published. I've also tried just, quote, common sense portion control and limiting or eliminating certain foods. I've tried to cut out added sugar more times than I can count. Same for processed wheat and dairy at various different times. After just a few days, the cravings become unbearable. The physical compulsion to gorge on these foods is overwhelming. But despite 40 years of diet failure, I decided to try the Whole30 at the beginning of this year. To my huge surprise, I found that when eliminating added sugar, grains, and dairy at the same time, plus legumes and alcohol as directed on the Whole30, the cravings were actually manageable. For the first time ever, I've been able to eliminate these evil ingredients, move through the cravings because they were far less severe, and come out the other side no longer needing any of it. As I write this, I'm currently on day 20. I had to consult a calendar to figure that out because I actually stopped counting the days a week or so ago, so I guess it wasn't torture. I don't intend to stop at day 30. This is my new lifestyle. For the first time in my life, I can actually consciously control what I eat. It's the most liberating thing ever. Of course, I miss sugar, wheat, and dairy products, but I don't crave them. I don't have an overwhelming physical compulsion to consume them. And I'm elated by the physical effects. I'm down to belt holes. I'm satisfied with less food overall. My grocery bills have actually gone down. I guess the more nutrient-dense your foods, the less you need. My energy level is way up. My emotional outlook is greatly improved. Heartburn and several other digestive issues have totally cleared up. Minor aches and pains are totally gone. For the first time in my life, I feel the way I've always imagined, quote, normal people feel. And he writes, I don't mean to sound like an infomercial for the Whole 30, but what it's done for me is truly transformational. So that's the ideal case. And I have to say that my experience of the Whole 30 was, you know, not as dramatic, because I think the worse off you are if you're a pre-diabetic or overweight or really suffering fatigue issues or brain fog and your diet's kind of crappy and you're at the mercy of your cravings, it is more likely that you're going to have a really transformational result. As for me, you know, as I said, I think my energy is better. I think I have a better handle on my cravings. My productivity is improved. And that's actually a very important thing for me because, you know, I see patients every day. I do these podcasts. I do a lot of writing. And it's important to be focused. So, you know, we spend much of our time, you know, especially in our dissipated youth, trying to unfocus. You know, we drink a lot and smoke pot and, you know, kind of like, you know, fuzz our brains up. But there comes a certain time of life when you want to be efficient and accomplish a lot. And many of our jobs are very demanding, where we, you know, realize that it's important to optimize energy and focus, and even at the expense of depriving of ourselves of certain foods that we might gravitate to, if the results are commensurate with sufficient reward, we're going to do it. And I think that that's why I'm gravitating towards staying on this diet or a reasonable facsimile thereof. You know, add to that an element of personal vanity, you know, anti-aging, you know, look good, that whole thing. There is certainly something to be said for this. So I'm going to come down in favor of the diet, but I want to issue a little bit of a caveat, which is this, is that one of the problems with this type of diet is that it is it can be something that can trigger or exacerbate what is called orthorexia. Orthorexia means literally straight eating. And it's a term that's coined, oh, maybe 20 years ago or so by my colleague, Dr. Stephen Bratman, MD. So that's his claim to fame. And it's a great term. It's come to signify overly narrow food consumption bordering on obsession. So people spend all day long worrying precisely about every morsel of food that they put in their mouth. And that is not a good way to eat. And most recently, Michael Pollan has inveighed against this whole way that Americans are. You know, good foods, bad foods. He says, look, all foods are good. You want to, you know, eat natural. Don't go overboard. Don't get carried away. Don't become obsessed. I would say I'd be a little bit more proactive than Michael Pollan, because I think if you're lackadaisical about what you eat, you know, some people, that's just not good enough. You have to be more proactive and focused. You know, if you just, quote, eat healthy, you know, you could find yourself 20 pounds overweight, mildly hypertensive, and in need of a statin drug, even if you buy all your food at Whole Foods and, you know, try to eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables and avoid refined foods. You could still, you know, get in trouble. And that's actually the way the prelude to one of the Whole 30 books starts. It starts with food, describes the diet of a typical health seeker. You know, they may have, you know, whole grain granola for breakfast with skim milk, or low-fat yogurt with fruit. And, you know, it just doesn't cut it. It doesn't cut it. They just don't feel good, or they have some health problems. So, but the problem is, if you get overly carried away with this, that, you know, you're such a precise eating mode, don't let your whole identity revolve around your exquisitely impeccable diet, because that is not a good way to go forward in life. You're going to be a real bore to your friends if you run around proselytizing them, and you know, you can adopt certain social maneuvers. If people keep urging unhealthy foods on you, come on, you know, just have a bite of this. It's delicious. I get it. But I think that's, you know, one of the downsides of this is that, you know, there are a fair number of people out there who have sort of an eating disorder, quasi-anorexic psychology. And I just hope that this, you know, diets like this don't trigger obsessive behavior on the part of some individuals who might take this a little too far. You know, we can be pure, but, you know, there's a difference between discipline and obsessive compulsion. So with that caveat in mind, it's really worth trying. I'm going to share more information with you about the diet in future broadcasts and podcasts. We'll try and get the Hartwigs on to discuss their program, hopefully in the near future. But and this, by the way, is not the one way, the only way to implement a paleo-style diet. There are other ways, but this is actually one of the more popular vehicles out there that's easily implementable and user-friendly. So check it out, Whole30.com, and the books are The Whole 30 and a book called It Starts with Food. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.